today I'm here with Matt Wise, who is the CEO of Q Interactive. And I've known Matt through a friend, I guess, for a little while and came to an event of mine in New York. Matt, thanks a lot for being here today.
My pleasure, Adrian.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about who you are and a little bit about Q Interactive. I don't actually know much about Q Interactive apart from the fact that you run Cool Savings.
Sure. Well, that's an excellent place to start. We do own and operate Cool Savings. And as a matter of fact, the company used to be called Cool Savings. We were publicly traded. We went public in 2000. Right as bubble burst. I think our stock price went up about 10% before plumbing about 90%. So for all those of you who invested early on, I wasn't part of the company, so don't blame me. But anyway, the business is actually an interesting one because its origin was in coupons, and that's what Cool Savings was all about. But over time, what occurred was we were getting paid, you know, 6 cents a print per coupon. And players like Uncle Ben's came to us and said, this printing coupons is great, and we'll pay you 6 cents for each one, but you know, we really want to talk to our consumers. We want to open a dialogue with them. So if you could, instead of printing a coupon for them, get them to sign up for a newsletter and raise their hand for permission to talk to them, we'd love that, and we'd pay you $2 a person. So for us back in our offices, at the time we were a little slow, and we said, 6 cents, $2, 6 cents, $2. I wonder which one we should do. So luckily, by 2004, we figured out that this lead generation thing was really the way to go, and that advertisers really wanted to start a dialogue with consumers, and they wanted us or a firm like us to figure out who were the right folks to talk to and who was actually going to convert, as opposed to them just going out and buying general banners. Thus was born the concept of a lead gen network. So we had been doing lead generation on the site since about 99. By 2004, we had inverted the model and made it available to other publishers. As a frame of reference, when we were a public company, we were doing about $30 million in revenue on Cool Savings. In the fourth quarter of 2004, we did about $5 million in our newly formed lead generation ad network. And then in 2005, we did about $37 million on the network and about $30 million on our historical Cool Savings. So in the span of 18 months, we became we shifted the entire business model from a Cool Savings-centric business to an ad network-centric business. And that has continued to grow. The lead generation business and the publisher business continues to grow, and we've expanded outside of just lead generation into email. And all of this is founded upon a simple concept, which is the best way to match consumers' advertising, we have found, is to use very rich data for the targeting. So that may sound like a bit cliche or a bit boring than what everybody else does, but the reality is since we sit behind registration usually, or we're doing email where we have access to the registration information, we know a tremendous amount about the consumer. We know their name, we know their address, we know their age. From that, we can buy external databases so we can figure out creditworthiness and a variety of other things. And we use all of that to come up with advanced targeting algorithms to figure out the right offer for this consumer at a given time. And then on the fly, we take all of our predictive modeling and we test that in the open marketplace. So it runs against the network and hundreds of thousands of people come in and we're constantly saying, is this predictive model predicting consumer activity accurately? Are people really taking this particular offer the most? And so it's constantly reaffirmed. Yeah.
So what happened to Cool Savings? I mean, the original idea was that it's coupons and people can sign up and get coupons. And so you just gravitated towards the lead generation business and naturally defocus on the coupon stuff. Is that how it works?
Yeah, for all kinds of purposes, the Cool Savings still exists. The site still exists and we still have coupons on there. But we actually sold the coupon technology about a year ago to News America. So although we still run what is one of the largest, if not the largest coupon destination site, we don't power the coupons. We outsource that aspect of it.
And your focus is, are you more of, when you say network, are you a co-registration network generating leads?
Co-registration, yes. Most people would think of us as a co-registration network. The reason we call ourselves a lead generation network as opposed to a co-registration network is people can't sign up. The old model of co-registration was you sign up for one thing and you're automatically signed up for two or three more. We never allow a consumer to sign up for offers simultaneously. They always have to go through an additional step, read more about a particular offer, confirm that they're really interested in that offer. But for the clarity and simplicity for folks, when they think about it, yes, we're usually post-registration or a co-registration player.
Do you allow pre-check leads, or do you always force them to go through at least one more step?
We do allow pre-check leads, but whenever you have a pre-check lead, they have to go through one more step. So we view the pre-check as a recommendation. So if there's 20 offers on a page, five of them may be pre-checked. Those are our recommendations. If a person hits submit at the bottom of that page, they have to read more about each one of those offers. If we have what's called an easy opt-in, where it's just a one step, which is about I think 0.5% of our revenue, we don't recommend it to advertisers, but if someone really wants to drive slightly less qualified volume, we do allow that, but we don't allow it to be pre-checked, meaning if it's only a one-step opt-in, they have to actively check on their own.
So let's say I'm a user going through your site, and I sign up for five offers pre-checked, and I hit submit. What does it mean by I have to read more? Does that mean I have to take an extra step to say, yes, I do want to list five offers?
Yes. So what happens specifically is, let's say you picked a Walmart offer, the JCPenney offer, and this Disney Music Club offer. So you pick those three, you press submit. What will happen is for each one of those, a new page will load, and it will say, here's all the information that we got on you that we're planning to pass to Disney. We always ask another custom question, so the consumer has to interact with the ad so we know it's a bona fide person, and then the person has to hit submit again. And there's always a skip button there so they can say, oh, now that I understand what I'm signing up for, I don't want to do this. Because some of them have expenses like Better Homes and Garden Magazine. You make the magazine today and you have to pay for it eventually. So we want to make sure that's all clearly disclosed to the consumer before they press submit. As a matter of fact, for some of the more...
I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
No, obviously that kind of stuff in the past has been quite problematic with the pre-checked and, you know, you go through someone's registration pass and you end up with 10 billion emails coming every day. I mean, with what you're doing now, is that avoiding that kind of stuff of people getting overwhelmed and, you know, never wanting to come back to whatever site was again?
Right. If done appropriately, it's not bad for the consumer at all, because the consumer always knows what they're signing up for. Two things can go awry, though. So, yes, it does get, it avoids the old, which is why we hate to use the word co-registration. It avoids the old situation where you came in and signed up for one site and all of a sudden you got signed up for 10 other things and you didn't know it. So a consumer always knows it's possible, actually, to get through and say, I didn't know I signed up for the gap. Because not only did you get a little pre-checked or unchecked box that you had to check, but then you get this fuller page, which you had to interact with, you had to confirm all your information, you had to answer another question, you had to submit again. And actually, for complicated ones where we have a telephone call following it or something like that, we actually do a triple opt-in, where after you press submit, we'll put a little warning box up that said, hey, did you really read this closely? Someone's going to give you a call. Are you sure you want a call? And they have to press submit again. So rarely do we run into consumer problems where they signed up for too many things. What we do find, however, is there are some less scrupulous players in the field that when you sign up for a site, they take your data and they resell it to five or six other players. And so you've only signed up for one site, but now you're getting mail from six other players and you don't know how, why you're getting this information. And the reason is because your data is being resold.
As you went through the sign-up.
Exactly.
And so what's your policy on that kind of stuff?
So our policy is that permission should be clear and conspicuous, meaning it should be on the page in one of two formats, either what we call an active opt-in, which is there's a checkbox that is not checked, so you're probably going to get about a 20% conversion error, or what we call a passive opt-in, where we pre-check the opt-in box, but it clearly says, hey, you're opting in for mail. And you can say right there if you're opting in for mail from, let's say, Cool Savings, or you're opting in for mail from Cool Savings and other parties. So the consumer can say, ooh, I don't want that, and can clearly uncheck it. And we think every time a piece of mail is sent, it should say, hey, you signed up on, for instance, Cool Savings, that's why you're getting this piece of mail. And the consumer should always be able to, with one click, say, well, I don't want to get any other mail from Cool Savings or anybody else that you gave permission to at that time. If you do all that, you put all the power in the consumer's hands. And it still allows for direct marketers and promotional marketers to run a robust business. It just enables the consumer to have a choice whether they want to opt into it and then, two, easily have an ability to get out of it.
The way I've heard one guy who does a lot of email talk about is when you get some email addresses, like through co-registration, you're getting those email addresses at the same time as a bunch of other guys, so you've got to send them more mail sooner until they stop using that email address.
Right, so that's what the unscrupulous players do. There's a race, literally, to the minute to get out mail. And the most common practice is something we call brand spawning. So, for instance, you sign up for a site, and this is most prolific in the free giveaway site, so you sign up for free iPods. 5 minutes later, literally, you get a piece of mail from greatstuff.com. You have no idea, and someone owns the URL on that. This is for example purposes only, but you get something from greatstuff.com, you never signed up for greatstuff.com, you have no idea how they get your email address. And what happened was is the free iPod folks sold your name and now they're paying it. And so the unscrupulous players will sell that to 5, 10, even 20 players, and all of them race to get the mail out because they know in days or a few weeks that mailbox is going to have literally thousands of pieces of mail in it and it's going to die. So, or it's going to become unproductive. So they want to get in as quickly as possible before it becomes unproductive. But again, the players who participate in that are not good players. I mean, that occurs out there, but that is definitely the low-end players who are doing that.
Yeah, and actually, I'll just add in as a note, like, in the free iPod example, I actually interviewed, and he was there, the free iPod guy was there at our cocktail, and they were doing some email stuff in the beginning, but his overall concept of what he wanted to do with the free iPod program was to create a brand, and so they stopped doing any kind of email follow-up fairly shortly into the program.
Yep, so, and so if you want to create a brand, that email practice will clear, so.
Yeah. All right.
And the Gratis folks did a fantastic job. They were one of the early pioneers, and they did a fantastic job at it for a long time.
Yeah, right. So, basically, the way you started out was with a coupons network and then people signing up for coupons. You then had a company saying, hey, coupons are nice, but we want leads and we'll pay more for leads. So you put the registration part behind the sign-up process for Cool Savings. You then started to see that, hey, this is working really well, this co-registration stuff or lead generation stuff. And so we'll start to make this the focus of our business. And then you start taking out that registration or the lead generation process and taking that to other businesses so they can also generate leads for you. Is that correct, Evolution?
That's a precise evolution, yep. The one thing that's a step in there, which you didn't mention, but it's an important one, is, you know, not only did we find out that lead generation was a good idea, but when we had so many advertisers coming to us who wanted lead generation, we ended up with a very simple problem of what advertisers should we put up. And so Bus was born in the beginning of our yield management system. And so right now, you know, doing lead generation is a relatively simple concept on the surface. You put it, you know, Walmart wants lead, you put the Walmart offer up, someone fills it out, and you send a day fee to Walmart. Where it gets complicated is predicting what consumers actually want Walmart and when the Walmart offer is going to yield higher than, let's say, the Disney offer or the Target offer or the mortgage offer, whatever else it may be. And so that's where you get the higher-end players building very complex algorithms and mathematical equations to predict that. And then there's a whole other business on the back end of that of how do I confirm that the person was bona fide. Not only in the user experience we try to do that, but we do it in the background by cleaning up addresses, checking on addresses, preparing the data to be sent over to the client, et cetera. so that you know, on the service, we all look similar because we all arrive at a page and there's a form there. But as, you know, everything from how that form was presented and what happens in the background, there's a tremendous amount of work that occurs. So those tools we built up along the way also.
Hmm. And so what kind of eCDN can people see for their site by adding your registration part?
It stretches anywhere. I mean,
I'm sorry, yeah, I didn't know this model that well, so I don't know what the monetization term, whether that eCPM or something else.
No, eCPM is what we use. And so it depends on the implementation. So we have people at the low end who are doing what we would call the soft touch puzzle. So they may be presenting only 6 offers, no pre-checks, and they'll exclude some of the more hardcore direct marketing players who pay high premiums. So on those, you may be talking about on a page a $75 CPM, which for most people, if they get a $75 CPM on a banner impression, would be fantastic. That's at the very low end. At the high end, our best performers who have the most aggressive paths, who you got to go through a lot of work to get through, quite frankly, probably peak out at, I would say $1,800 CPM. So, you know, it's $1.80 a person. So there's a large span in between. Our average is around $500 CPM. I think it's about $520.
So from the point of view of the user, like you're going through to do something and then you're getting put through one of these hard registration processes that you end up being worth $1.80 a person. How did I get that data all back out to the advertiser? I mean, it seems astonishing that that works. I mean, what is in the user's mind? Like, why are they saying, I've got to complete this next offer. I have to fill this stuff in.
Right. So the key is, and what we demand of all of our publishers, is that the consumer never feels they have to fill it in. So there are, I mean, again, you're getting into, this is why this industry is a little complicated. There are unscrupulous players who insinuate to the user that they have to fill something out in order to get to the next page. So we control and demand of all of our publishers that they never put any language that may infer, insinuate, or anything else that an offer has to be taken, because otherwise you start to degrade the quality of leads you send in. But the reason these folks can generate such a high CPM is, and most of those high CPMs are generated on promotional sites, is they attract consumers who like to sign up for stuff. And I know that might sound crazy, and many folks think that, you know, high-end sites like About.com is one of our partners, and wow, signing up for a newsletter there is going to be a higher quality individual than somewhere else. The reality is those are good people. However, the folks who come to promotional sites really like to sign up for stuff. It's just in their nature. So when they come to the site, they see, and our offers, you know, many of them are very good. You know, there's discounts, there's newsletters of interest for everything under the sun, there's discounts on magazines. So they end up looking through there and finding a lot of stuff they like and signing up for a bunch of it. Again, to generate $1.80 a person, although from a $1,800 CPM sounds egregious, about 40%, 40 to 50% of the people who come to our page find something they're interested in. So, you know, most banners have a click-through of 0.2%. We have about a 40% conversion rate, meaning people come to the page, find them, they like, fill out the form, press submit. So if we're getting on average on that side $1 a conversion, well, that's already generating, you know, 50 cents. So if they convert on 3 offers, they sign up for, you know, just a few of them, then they've got $1.50 or a $1,500 ECPM. And then if you take that a step further, that some of the leads that we generate, if it's an education lead or a mortgage lead, these highly qualified leads, you know, those people are paying $30, $40, $50 leads. You don't have to sign up a heck of a lot of those people to make the needle really move.
And so then, and while this is all going on, you have your process optimized so that it's putting the best, most high perform, most revenue generating leads first. So that's the publisher's interest and also your interest. And therefore potentially the consumer's interest because they're getting showing the offers where, or I don't know whether it's necessary, the offers they can spend most money, maybe the offers that are most relevant to them.
Right. So the algorithm works much like Google in the fact that the, who gets shown at the top of the page is actually a combination of propensity to click and convert. So how attractive is the offer and then a rate paid by the advertiser. So two of those together result in yield. And then the yield is not just across all consumers, so it's not like we say, on this site, this is the best performing offer. We say, in front of this consumer, on this site, this is the best performing offer. So, you know, a woman age 23 is going to see a radically different set of offers than a man age 55. You know, a 23-year-old woman may see a lot of Pampers, Walmart, JCPenney, et cetera, Disney Book Club, because we're aiming at their propensity to have children, et cetera, and an older male may have mortgage refinance or automotive loan or retirement or AARP or who knows what that matches up with them.
So an interesting case is, are you familiar with the social networking site called Tagged, tag.com?
Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with it. I can't say I'm part of it.
Yeah, it's more for teens. Alexa ranked 120, using viral marketing pretty effectively, generating about 300,000 leads, sign-ups per day, so sign-ups per site. And so Greg, the CEO, he put co-registration on his sign-up process, and that was sort of a big breakthrough, I think, that helped bring the site to being profitable. Is that the sort of site you like to work with, and then you use the data points you're collecting on users to help target those better? I mean, how do you work with a site like Tagged?
Yeah, so we love the social networking thing is a fantastic spot just because consumers are providing information and there are people who are willing to provide information, which is one of the keys to our targeting and the success of lead generation. You need to find people who are willing to pass over that information. You know, one of the challenges we have in social networking is the youth aspect of it. If we go too far down the youth level, we can't monetize people under 13. So there's a break point there. And then there's just a break point in how much revenue you can generate off of the 13 to 21 year old group. It's tremendously valuable from a impression and display arena, meaning there are many advertisers who want to influence that group, but the price points paid by many of the advertisers in lead generation are higher for people who have higher incomes and have the ability to convert, so they have credit cards, et cetera. Do we like social networking? You bet. It's a great segment, and for a player like that, we probably, most of the stuff is automated. They're going to pick up the offers, but we may work on some creative implementations to push the more youth-oriented offers up the spectrum so that they can for their users.
So what is the ideal kind of traffic that you want most? Is it women age 30 to 50?
It's actually, yes, very, very close to that. It is women probably aged just a little younger than that, probably 25 to 50. And the reality is we like all traffic. And I know it sounds a little ubiquitous, but the selection of offers, we have about 1,500 advertisers a year running through the system. So we have offers that appeal to all the different segment groups, whether retirees, young people, old people, et cetera. But those who monetize the absolute best are middle-aged women. Or not even a little younger than middle age women. They just shop more online, they buy more online, they're more willing to sign things online, et cetera.
So when one of these goes onto a site, does it affect the branding of the site? I mean, do people look at that and say, man, you know, now this site used to be really good, and now they're wanting me to get a free gift card, or they want me to fill my information for, so I can call back by, you know, whoever. Does that actually have a detrimental effect on site at your lead generation path in?
Not if they do it right. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you, there are a tremendous number of ways to handle the execution of the advertising. So if you handle the advertising with the consumer in mind that they can always get out of it easily, then it's not a problem. It's just like an interstitial on the New York Times. You know, when you get that interstitial, as long as the skip button is there, no one really minds. You know, if the ad is of interest, they look at it. If it's not of interest, they click on skip and they get by real quick and get to their article. So same thing with us. We put up 10 offers in between someone signs up and the user experience says, thanks for signing up. We have these 20 offers we thought you might be interested in also. So right there, what happens is, one, you've positioned it as a positive to the consumer that we found something of interest. Two, as long as you work with a player like us or another high-end player, those offers that show up actually will be of interest. There'll be something likely on the page. Again, have people convert. So most likely it's going to be something on the page that's of interest to them. But if there's not, if they have zero desire to interact or nothing on the page of interest, as long as with a single click they can say skip and move on, then we find there to be zero interference with or bad impressions with the consumer. And we reflect on that in two ways. One, we can track how many people abandon the site in our advertising, so we say that is not the optimal user experience. And we can see as publishers choose to get more aggressive, put more ads up, put more pages up, that attrition rate gets higher. And then secondarily, we work with advertisers who often passes publishers who often passes back end statistics. So they'll say, hey, we did an A/B split test where 50% of our users went through your path and 50% didn't. And we saw that, you know, there was a 10% degradation of interactions of that consumer once they passed through your path. And so depending on how big that degradation is, we can see if we've affected the user experience or the brand experience in the back end. Now, a little degradation is okay, because the reality is a consumer only has a limited amount of time to interact with the site. You know, many sites have a 4-minute interaction time. So if they're on my pages for a minute and a half of that or 2 minutes and they're filling out a couple of offers, then they get to the core website, well, they probably have less time to interact with the core website, which is okay for some folks, because let's say, you know, they earn $1 off of my registration or even 50 cents, and then when they go to their regular website, they maybe peruse through 15 pages on average, and each one of those has a, you know, a $3 CPM. So they only earn $15 or 15 cents in the back end, but they earn 50 cents off of us. Maybe we burn 10% of the time, so they only made 14 or 13 cents on the background, but they still made 50 cents off of us, so it's a huge gain. So that's what we try to keep an eye on. If you're not scrupulous about it, if you're not careful about it, though, yeah, you can definitely stack up a bunch of ads, take away the skip button, and make it very difficult for the consumer to move on, and then the experience becomes one that is substantially less positive.
So one of my friends is Drew Kurtz, who runs Fark.com. Have you ever heard of that site?
Fark.com?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just saw him out at the Venture Summit last week.
Oh, really?
I didn't talk to him personally, but he was up on a panel. Seems like a great guy.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Yeah, and he's come to a couple of my events. I talked with him about this sort of stuff on his site, and his kind of viewpoint is, he's pretty anti-advertising anyway. He's more of a tech guy, really. But his viewpoint is, look, you know, my guys, they're Linux users, or general US, they're male, 18 to, I guess, 40 or 50, I think he talked about, and they're using Firefox, and they're running ad blockers, and, you know, they're complaining about advertising, all that kind of stuff. How would you work with someone like Drew?
So we definitely would work with Drew, and the implementation we would use, given his user base, would be slightly lighter, meaning we'd make sure we didn't put too many barriers up in front of the consumer. But again, the ads that are shown will be shown in optional format, meaning they can say, hey, something is of interest on this page or not. And for the Fark.com folks, I actually think it would be a good user experience, because the nature of Fark.com is I'm coming here to peruse through a bunch of interesting news sites and funny stories, and I'm going to pick out the ones I want to read about. So our advertising would be presented in the same exact way. Here are 20 ads and offers that we thought you might be interested in. Peruse through, pick up the one you want. If you don't like any, keep moving on. So a paradigm is perfect.
Did you put those between the articles? Like when someone clicks on an article, or are you suggesting, is that, I talked to him about that and he said that would create like a revolution, he felt. would it be when a user signs up to the site, or would it be some add-on site, in which case he's mentioned that while it gets a ton of traffic, the click-throughs on that tend to be fairly low.
Yep. So I would do two things. One, I would do maybe three. I would do registration. You can't bang on people every single time they're on the site with this interrupted flow or every time they click on an article. It's kind of like an interstitial. If every time you clicked, you got another interstitial, you'd get annoyed. But if you came to the site and once every time you're on the site or once an hour or whatever it may be, you got an interstitial, that'd be fine, in my opinion. I don't think my users would have a problem with that. And they all know they're getting free content, so the message could be, hey, check out these offers from our sponsors. One, we've not just picked random ones. We pick ones we think you're interested in. Two, you understand we're advertising-driven, so this is how we make our money. And three, if you don't like it, no problem. Just click close or click skip, and you can go back to reading your articles. So we would probably recommend they do it on registration, and then at some intermittent time, you know, maybe every 10th article or something like that, they get one of these, and I'd probably use the equivalent of an interstitial, and which there were maybe 10 offers on there, and they have to pick from one of the 10. And if they didn't want to do it, they'd press skip, keep moving on. And I'd probably, I was going
to
say, especially for FARC.com, I would lead with a message of why I was putting this up. That, hey, I'm not putting this up to annoy you, I'm putting this up because we're an advertising-driven site.
Yeah, someone, and see, he'd have a revolution on his hands, and I mean, because they're a loud and noisy group, so they'd be complaining an incredible amount. But at the end of the day, it's whether they stop using the site or whether they continue using it and it generates revenue. His average user does comes to the site and click on two news articles when they come, and I guess they come every day or every couple of days. So maybe you'd suggest, like, once every 5 click-throughs, they get shown something.
Yeah, something like that. So, you know, they wouldn't necessarily even see it every day, they'd see it every couple of days.
And then something like that. What do you think, how much revenue do you think that would generate for showing?
Much less, because when you get someone fresh for registration, there's where you're going to get your big dollars. Your intermittent tags later on, you know, you might be down in the $20 CPM or something like that. And on the registration on FARC.com, you know, I would guess he would be up around the, it would probably do a light implementation, so maybe a $350 CPM. So, I mean, for a player like that who does large volumes, I mean, there's some players who write enormous checks for because they have large volumes, and there's, you know, if you're registering a lot of people, I mean, it's just an enormous money to be made. Most sites don't have a large registration base. I mean, most sites are registering, you know, hundreds a day, maybe if they're very large, you know, 1,000 a day. But some of these social network sites, some of these viral sites are registering in tens of thousands and, a day. And when you're in the tens of thousands and you're getting paid, you know, 50 cents a registration, it's not a lot of money every day. Day in, day out.
Drew is generating a lot of daily registrations. He's generating a lot of daily visitors, and then some of them sign up for stuff, and he hasn't pushed that side of it. But his daily uniques is 1-2 million.
Yeah, so he has a huge, he's got a huge general reach. I don't know what, you know, the, I don't know what his stats on registration are. You see, he's in push. I'm not sure exactly what volume he's getting there.
I don't think that the actual registration is that high. I don't think he's really pushed the people's incentive to go ahead and register.
I see. You have an opportunity for him. I know he lives a comfortable lifestyle, so I don't know if he wants to even delve into it, but there's definitely money to be made there.
And can you give a crazy out-of-the-air ballpark figure on what that could generate for you?
Well, I mean, let's say he was doing 10,000 registrations a day, and we were generating 50 cents per registration at $5,000 a day. That's $1.5 million a year, roughly.
Do you think that's absurd, or is that what kind of...
That'd be an average. That'd be an average ECPM conversion. Now, the 10,000 registration today might be a landishly high form or might be low.
And you mean that user registration, is that in user sign up to site, or is that in showing these to users as a click through news article? Because that's
no, I say, right. I say that's user registration. On the click throughs, it would be a much lower CPM, although the frequency would be higher. I hate even hazard a guess, but, you know, maybe there's another $500,000 in that form.
So if he was to pick up his way users sign up to the site and really encourage them to register and then put them through this registration process, that's $1.5 million a year potentially there, and then putting them through occasionally in the advertising in a way that doesn't freak people out too much would be another $500,000. So he could add on another $2 million in profits to his site every year.
Yep. Don't call me. It's humorous that you ring up Drew because he was a panel of five folks, and he's a person that I've got on my list that I want to give a ring to in the next couple of weeks. Just to chat about this. So Drew, if you're listening, I'll be calling you.
Yeah, he'll be reading the interview.
Yeah.
All right, so in the beginning when you were talking, you talked about targeting and predictive models. Was that what you were referring to, what you show, the kind of offers you show users as they're going through the sign-up process?
Yeah, we're doing this on two ends. So one is just what consumers have a propensity to pick. So they're just looking down the list, and we're looking at them saying, hey, this is female 35. They have a higher likelihood of taking the Better Homes and Garden offer than they do the Sears Sighting offer. However, we also use advanced predictive modeling for back-end conversions. So a continuity club may come to us and say, we're going to share back files with you of who actually converts. So the first thing the targeting engine does is look at consumers and say, who has a propensity to convert for the book club? And then the book club has this back file that said, hey, you sent us 10,000 people, 8,000 of them converted, 5,000 of them were fantastic converters. So then we feed that back into the predictive model. So when we look at consumer, we say, not only are you probably interested in this offer, but you're interested enough that you're probably going to convert well for the advertiser.
You're
so we have lots of, pardon me?
You're doing scorecarding.
Yeah, that's one way to put it.
Who do you work with? Who do you generate your scorecards? Is that fair? ISAC, or do you work with someone else?
No, we do it all ourselves. So they give us, we do that. We also work with some offline data companies, one of which is a company called Alliant, who aggregates pay-up rates from people like National Geographic, BMG Music Club, and others. And then they create custom models and scores on people, so we have a propensity for people to pay their bills, so we can apply that to the algorithm. But the rest of the algorithms are built. We have a staff of about half a dozen statisticians and mathematicians who, this is all they do, is build the models and advance the targeting.
Alan, was that something like you introduced one day, the next bucket to make a big difference when you started doing it?
It's a constant iterative process. What I mean by that is, you know, at first it was just, hey, you put different offers in front of men and females, and then step by step, it got more and more complicated. To now, it's actually so complicated sometimes you wonder where offers are or why offers are showing up. But, you know, there's the targeting engine is smarter than the rest of us in figuring out what people will likely want. So each time we make an advance, you know, add another data point on or something like that, it raises yields anywhere from usually 1% to 5%, depending on how advanced the targeting element is. It's hard, you know, once you get up here, once you get the easy strikes out of the way, it's hard to continue to find mathematical ways to increase yield. But the specific one I just referenced, which was with Alliant, and using offline scoring of consumers and consumer groups on offline behavior, was actually a big mover, because many of those players, many of those magazine companies couldn't make online lead generation work, because too many people were signing up and saying, yeah, put me on a list and then send me a bill. And they wouldn't pay for their magazine once it arrived, so they'd be in bad pay-up rates. And for a magazine, or a Hanui Club, those are the death knell, because they have a huge expense going out the door. It's not just, hey, a consumer signed up, but I put a mag and I paid $6 to get this consumer, but then I put a magazine in the mail and I mailed the magazine, so now I'm in for another 3 or 4 hours. So if the person never pays their bill, I'm really out a lot. So, our ability to score those consumers and predict this group of people has an 80% likelihood to pay their bill, these people 90%, these people 70%, you know, what decile do you want to buy to? That was a huge move in the continuity and magazine arena. For many players, they just couldn't do business without it.
Did you infer that? That's all in house. You just find your own statisticians. You don't have any like magic formula or like what data points do you bring in? Are you like looking up things on each user to determine stuff? Like, do you access any like Equifax databases or things in real time to make sure things work, or is it just based on the data that you have?
It's twofold. We do buy data from Alliant and some other players, not all of which we disclose. Most of it is done behind the scenes prior to the consumer's arrival. So we take consumers and we can match the likelihood of activity, et cetera, before they arrive. But we do some things on the fly. Like we do behavioral targeting. The person, our behavior is not, they surf somewhere, but they actually took an offer. So maybe they took a fitness offer, and therefore we're going to show them a health food offer next, because, you know, the propensity for them to take one after the other is very high. So we'll do that stuff on the fly. We'll do a lot of the pay-up rates and a lot more of the advanced mathematics behind the scenes, so that when they arrive, we can immediately peg them to a particular user group. But we can predict ethnicity. I can predict household income. I can predict likely to own a home versus rent, a whole plethora of things.
Right. Is this the main part of your business? Like, are there other aspects of your business that we haven't talked about that we should?
That's the lead generation is the primary aspect, but we use the same algorithms, the same approach in email. So, for instance, for a publisher, just like we monetize their registration path, we can also monetize their email. And we use the same logic of, let's take a look at all the consumers, let's figure out what the best offer to match that consumer is on a given day. And the reason that's different from most other players is most players say, hey, I'm running, you know, whoever may be all recipes, and therefore I'm going to sell my entire list of Betty Crocker today, all, you know, whatever it is, 3 million people. Well, the reality is, we can see, because we see hundreds and actually thousands of offers, that mailing Betty Crocker isn't the best thing to everybody. So one subsegment of that list is going to like Betty Crocker, but we can predict that another subsegment of that list is actually more in the market for Walmart today, and that more people will click, convert, and generate more yield on Walmart than will on Betty Crocker. And so what we do is, when we take a list, we score that entire list the night before and say, okay, if I have a list of 2 million, 50,000 get this piece of mail, 50,000 get this piece of mail, 150,000 get the other piece of mail, et cetera. And every night we mail all those out, we track conversions, all that becomes intelligence back into the machine to figure out, okay, what are we going to send out on the next day? And so
how on earth do you figure out a user is likely to do something? I mean, all you have is their email address, or do you have more data?
Well, usually we have more data because when they go through these sites, we ask for the registration data, so we ask for the full data set. But for some subset of those people, the only thing we have is email. So for those people, we have to wait until they've taken an action before we can put them somewhere. So if all we know is they're on the all-recipe site, then my data levels are small, and I start sending them mail that I think affects that or appeals to that segment or that contextual site. But as soon as they take an offer, then I start to see some behavioral history behind that consumer, and I say, aha, they start to skew towards this behavioral group or that behavioral group, and I put them in there and send more like emails like that to them. So those are the two primary business models. And then we're just starting to dabble in banners. And the same concept is we're starting to target banners based on this deep rich data we have. So the idea is if you come to the site, you register, and if you use Q, we have the registration data. If they went through the registration path, we have the behavioral data from registration. If you're using us for email, we have responses in email. And then if they surf around the site, I know it's Joan Smith. I know she likes mortgage, or she's just taking a mortgage. She's just taking a car loan offer, and she passed up on the siting offer. So now what banner should I put up in front of her? So the amount of pardon me?
Is that able to generate enough volume in all the different behavioral reports that you always have problems with volume?
Right. So when we buy into open network, we have the same challenge. When I try to buy in ValueClick or ad.com or something like that, I have to run across my cookies. So volume is very difficult. But where we're a little different is if we handle the registration path for you, then obviously 100% of the people who came through registered, you know, all the people who registered, I should say, we have data on. So there, the penetration and the overlap is tremendously high, as opposed to, hey, I collected random behavioral data across the web. Let's see how many of those people run across your site. So it's two very different approaches. So I can't do volume. You know, if Walmart, what they do, comes to me and said, hey, I want to buy banners, I can't go out in the net and say, wow, I can find you 50 million people that have these behavioral characteristics. But if you run your own website and you say, hey, I want to target people on my website and I want to differentiate based on income, based on, or even ethnicity if you want it, but gender or whatever else, I can do that to, you know, 80% probably of people who register on your site because I'll have all the data on them. Now, some are going to wipe cookies, so I have to wait till I see them again so I can recognize them. But outside of that, you know, have a huge overlap.
So does that mean that you then want to serve all the ads on someone's site? Are you becoming like a CEO? How does that work?
So, yes, we would like to serve the ads on a person's site. And then what we'd like to do is say, look, if you can sell the ads in at a higher rate than we can, you fill the inventory. If we can find ads better than you can, which we think over time we'll be able to because our targeting algorithms will constantly match the right offer with the right consumer, then we take the spot. So it's a relatively low risk for the publisher because the publisher gets to say, look, I've got my own sales force. We're doing a good job. We're generating, an average of a $4 CPM. We'll come in and say, okay, let us have a shot in there too. And if we can generate higher than $4, we'll take space. If we can't generate higher than $4, you keep the space. And so there's very low risk for the publisher and hopefully put large potential upside for them as a lot of different advertisers start to come in and not run network advertising that they would get from every old network, but the stuff that would show up is very targeted.
What are you showing for advertisers? Are you taking people landing pages or are you putting through more registration processes?
Those players, so off the banners, they could do a registration page for a landing page for a particular offer or just over to someone's site. So, you know, trying to think of another, you know, Colorado Tourism, they want to drive people back to their site. But they may have come to us and said, we only want people from, you know, the surrounding four states. So most of the time, a contextual site would say, well, I can't do that. We, since we have the registration data, would say, no problem. We'll target this ad only to people in the four states surrounding Colorado. Or even a better example, we take offers where people have franchises, and they may have 150 locations around the country, and they want different ads in front of every one of them. That's a non-starter for most ad networks. For us, since we have the registration data, we say, no problem. You know, these leads will go to, this offer will go to the folks in Florida, this offer will go to the folks in southern Texas, et cetera. And the CPMs they pay, theoretically, would be substantially higher. So the banner network for us, the concept of the banner network is still in its early stage. We're just starting to test it out now. But from what we can see, it's going to be great.
Have you heard about what Frank Advantech is doing with the Rubicon Project?
Not specifically, no.
I did an interview with him a month ago, and he's creating like a network to handle stuff like yours. So basically a publisher, like let's say Fark, can come along and say, okay, these six guys want to run stuff on my site. I'll put them all into the Rubicon project, and then the Rubicon project will manage them all for me, and then let whichever one is performing best continue running ongoing. Because as I understand, it's actually a hard problem for the publishers is to keep switching all these different advertisers up.
Yes, it's tremendously difficult. So as a player, you know, Rubicon Project or, you know, Right Media Exchange or an ad ECN are all players that we'd be, you know, we'll probably work with. And all we're trying to do is facilitate exactly what we're trying to facilitate, which is let's take the burden off the publisher to have to pick a particular ad network. Let's find some vehicle or a particular advertiser. Let's find some vehicle that chooses the best for me on an ongoing basis.
Right. What about fraud? Do you have problems with fraud? In CDA network, it's a gigantic problem where people are signing up for offers using prepaid cards and a bunch of other techniques so they get a $20 commission on a $2 sign-up. Do you have that sort of problem?
Not that much. And the primary reason is the way we run our publisher network is we don't have a self-serve tool that allows moms and pops in. We contemplated that we just had never built it. So all the publishers we work with, we have specifically hand-chosen. So the likelihood that one of them would commit fraud is low because obviously they're going to get caught from us. So we don't have the same challenges many of the affiliate networks have where, you know, a publisher comes in and they don't worry about getting caught by an affiliate network because they're only doing, you know, 100 registrations a day. And if they get cut off from one affiliate network, they'll hop the next. And we don't do a lot on the credit card side. Most of our stuff is soft offers, meaning just sign up for a newsletter or whatever else. So there's not a lot of benefit for the random people to go sign up for, you know, 50-cent offers. They got to fill out literally thousands of them before they make any real money. However, fraud is still an issue, and it's fraud on two levels. One, you worry about individual publishers trying to boost their numbers by just typing in information. And then second, you worry about unbound fraud users. So the users, for whatever reason, and trust me, sometimes I have a hard time divining why consumers do things. But for instance, we have mortgage offers, which are probably one of the most burdensome offers to get through in our registration path, because you have to not only fill out your personal identifiable information, but you have to fill out a whole bunch of other information, financial, so a lot of different questions. And then we usually use a triple opt-in on mortgage offers. So the third time they popped up the window and said, hey, do you really want to get this offer? We have people who go through all that work, go to the triple opt-in, submit it, and then when they get a telephone call from the mortgage provider, the consumer said, I never signed up for this. Yet we have the record of what site they were on, the fact that they went through, you know, literally an extra 10 questions. So we try to figure out and divine whether people are being, putting in unbonafide information. So for whatever reason, they may feel compelled, or they may feel, even though we've written at the top of the page that it has no impact on a promotion, they may feel that, well, maybe that does have an impact, so I'm going to fill out something anyway. But we build screens in the background and say, okay, is this really a person? Does this person match the address they're at? Is this Red Flintstone, or is it some other commonly used and constructed fake name? And oftentimes we don't even correct that on the front form. Like if we see someone who says they're John Smith from 123 Main Street, you know, we let them submit that. We just take it in and we can it in the background. Now, unfortunately, some poor John Smith who lives at 123 Main Street signs up for stuff and never gets it, but those are ones we predict are more likely to be fraudulent than real, so we just take them out of the system. If we reject them on the front page, I was saying, if we reject them on the front page, then all the consumer does is keep getting creative until they find something we haven't discovered yet.
So you must be getting lots of nice registrations to 123 Fake Street, which is a missing fake address.
We do get lots of different fake ones. What I find interesting is the people aren't all that creative. When people make up addresses, you know, they're probably 50 that are the top 50 that everybody uses.
Are there any funny stories of fake information people have put in?
You know, there are only funny stories of the fact that you try to come up with all the different variations in advance, and yet, you know, someone always finds something. So I'm trying to think of one of the more humorous ones. We had Bart Simpson out there for a while. We finally took that out of circulation. But we just had one the other day that came in. That was some fictional character. I can't remember off the top of my head what's a superhero or whatever. And so obviously fictional, but we just hadn't thought to put it in the front filter. So now it's in there.
So someone ended up buying leads from Darth Vader, and so that's when you keep finding those, and you have to keep adding those to you.
Exactly. Yeah, some advertiser says, do you really believe Darth Vader's a real consumer? I'm like, oops, sorry about that.
All right, so I have one more question for you.
Yes.
Web 2.0 guys, I mean, they're all out there doing flashy Ajax screens, you know, all sorts of really slick stuff, and not making any money. Actually, I was talking to Drew about this just the other day, that there's three business models that I'm noticing on the Internet. There is websites that have a lot of traffic that don't make much money. There's there's a spectrum of aggressive to not aggressive to very aggressive direct marketers that really work hard to monetize users, and sometimes annoy people, but, you know, some do it less, like you guys, and then there's another end of the spectrum where they do it very aggressively. And then those are the two that I could think of, and the third that Drew added in was then there's venture-backed startups that have a lot of money and are going to run out soon. I'm talking to a lot of people, those are the models that I keep seeing. I'm interested in how you think about these Web 2.0 companies. I mean, some of them are generating a lot of traffic with their really slick Ajax stuff. One of them being Badu. Are you familiar with Badu?
Yep.
I try to get some contact in there and haven't managed to work it out yet, but I'm impressed with the amount of traffic and the stuff those guys are doing, and they have basically no monetization on their site. I mean, how do you talk with guys like that just don't seem to want to touch any of this stuff?
Well, so ultimately, everybody's going to want to monetize at some point or another, and YouTube's a more popular example maybe that brings the point that, you know, what they were doing was aggregating an audience. And what the web is a little behind in is the ability to monetize the passive audience. And people prep on television all the time, and people talk about how great the search engines are. But the reality is search engines are just, you know, Google and Yahoo right now are just the giant yellow book. That's all it is. Consumers know they want a BMW, so they go there to find a BMW and they can plead. And, yeah, they make billions of dollars, but those billions of dollars actually aren't all that much. I mean, that's billions of dollars, it's not pick on. But if you look at overall U.S. advertising spending, it's like $300 billion a year. And overall television dwarfs the web. And the reason is because television found a way, a compelling way, to monetize media sites. So folks like YouTube, folks like Baidu, folks like even Vark, for instance, are challenged with the fact that the medium, the Internet, hasn't come up with a good way to allow advertisers to talk to consumers without interrupting the flow too much. So lead generation is one of those where, hey, we're finding a way for consumers to actually raise their hand and say, I want to be marketed to in the future. But where the real money is going to be in the future actually is not lead generation. It'll always be a great niche. But the real money is going to be in how do I find a way in which I can embed advertising like a commercial on media sites. And so I think right now, it happened in 99 and it's happening again, people are aggregating audience together feeling like eventually someone's going to solve this problem for me. So if I get a huge following, if I'm like Facebook or I'm like MySpace, then eventually someone's going to come up with a paradigm to allow me to monetize these folks. And I think that's probably going to be a combination of video and display. So when I say display, it's going to be displayed on the site. It's going to have to be a rich media experience, so it's most likely going to be video. But no one's come up with the right standards and right implementation now that consumers have accepted in the same way they accepted 30-second advertisements. It'll happen. It didn't happen in 99, but it will happen eventually. So I think that's what these Web 2.0 companies are coming up with lots of flashy stuff and lots of cool user experiences are running into is they congregate the audience, but until someone solves this display element for them, It's just, and then it becomes complex and stuff to buy consumers. It's just going to be difficult for them to monetize.
So when told,
and I recommend they come to me, I'll help them out.
So you don't think your model will be the lead generation model will be the one for the long term? You think it's going to be a midterm model?
I think there'll always be a place for lead generation. I mean, the concept that someone goes and raises their hand and says, yes, I want to receive more from this advertiser is tremendously powerful, so there'll be a place for it. But you don't raise your hand and say, yeah, I want more for BMW until you've seen the BMW commercial, until you've been persuaded that BMW is the ultimate driving experience and you feel like you want to learn more about it. And so to do all that, I can't do that in a form. I need some rich media experience where I can show a car driving down, you know, of course I can get a feel for the Italian leather that's going to be on the inside or whatever else. Until I get that rich branding experience, you know, I can't drive, desires. All I can do is answer desires when people already know about BMW and I say, hey, you want to get a brochure for it? And they're like, oh yeah, I saw a television commercial for that the other day. That's where we work. That's where, quite frankly, that's where all the web works right now. With the exception of some of the viral stuff and some of the, display stuff. Generating interest is very difficult, and the web is not mastered yet, which is why it remains a $20 billion segment instead of a $100 billion segment.
And at some point, that's going to be cracked, and the web will become a $100 billion segment.
I have no doubt about it. And the math of people always complain about the fact that consumers spend more time on the Internet, but the Internet's not rewarded for that. And I think that's the wrong way to think about it. The reality is that people spend more time on web. The web hasn't figured out how to present advertisers with the ability to advertise there successfully. And I think, you know, Drew's reaction to, wow, I'll have a user revolution, is the challenge. I mean, people have now gotten used to the web being in a format it is and advertising being secondary. So until we sort that out with the consumer and find the right experience that they won't have a revolution about, the web will still be hampered. The web will still get a short on revenue or advertising dollars relative to other mediums.
Very interesting. I know we're running out of time here. Is there anything else you want to add in close?
No, you know, I appreciate the call. You know, I think your organization is a very interesting one, so I look forward to more interactions. And lastly, I'd say, you know, just from our perspective, we see just tremendous growth out there, both in the interactive space in general and in our lead generation space, but the key is to do it responsibly. So finding that right balance of feeding in advertising and but not disenfranchising the consumer. And to, you know, concerns about user revolution and stuff like that, you know, I think consumers have greater tolerance than most people appreciate for advertising as long as it's at their option and they can delete it when they want.
Very good.
So that close up.
Thank you very much for your time.
All right, Adrian, very good talking to you. Thank you.